Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we have Lillian Vasquez in conversation with John Tesh. We are currently airing John Tesh, Songs and Stories from the Grand Piano on KVCR-TV through early May. We'll hear about this and much more.
Up with sunrise, you'll be staring out through the window on the day.
First, though, with the rapidly approaching submission deadline for the NPR Tiny Desk Concert Contest, it's time we had the creator of the NPR Tiny Desk Concert on the program. I spoke with Bob Boylan quite recently, and it seems it started with a trip to the South by Southwest Music Festival in an attempt to hear music from Laura Gibson. And it didn't really work out that well.
Yeah, so anybody who's been to South by Southwest knows that any venue anywhere can get turned into a music venue. And so sometimes it's not the best sounding, though I've seen some of the most extraordinary shows there, and there are some beautiful sounding venues. But this particular one that we went to see Laura Gibson was mostly a bar of people watching a basketball game. And Laura happened to be singing, and we couldn't hear Laura sing. And so we couldn't hear Laura sing. She comes off stage. Stephen Thompson, my workmate here at NPR, says to Laura Gibson, "We couldn't hear you. Maybe it'd be a good idea if you just came and played a concert for us in our office, you know, a little private show for us." And he was, of course, joking. But my eyes lit up. My brain lit up. I thought, gosh, that would be amazing. So Laura was on tour with the Decemberists. And a couple of weeks later, she came by, put a microphone, sat her in my chair behind my desk. She had an acoustic guitar. She sang a handful of songs. If you watch that video, you can even see Stephen and I introducing Laura, and we say to her, "This could be the start of something, or maybe not, because who knew?"
Oh, wow. Oh, nice. That's one that I went back to, but I was skimming through so many things. I think we're talking about 800 or so of these on YouTube or something by now. That's really cool. And this ended up being quite a thing. Now, the name of the series, this is a play on the name Tiny Desk Unit. This is one of your early bands, yes?
Right. The first band I ever was in. I had quit my job working in a record store and bought an Arp Odyssey, a synthesizer. Never played music in my life. And I just ditched everything. I really wanted to do it. I thought, if I don't do this now, I'll never do it. And that was my path.
And you're still doing work with the Danger Painters today. Well, that's for a future interview. So generally speaking, I understand there's a bit of a rule, I've heard you mention this, of an artist only appearing once. Yet with Chris Thiele, I think four times, maybe five, once you even surprised him with a birthday cake.
So a couple of things. That rule is pretty hard and fast, which is that there are so many artists sending material our way that if I started repeating the ones I loved, it wouldn't make room for all the ones that I don't even know about that I will fall in love with eventually and be able to present to the world. But Chris Thiele is a kind of an artist, mandolin player for those who don't know, one of the best in the world, who will play with, you know, Yo-Yo Ma, play classical music on one hand, and then play with Nickel Creek on another, and then play more experimental music on another. So he's a chameleon of sorts, and when Chris has an idea, it's usually a good one and worth listening to and worth presenting to the world.
Oh, absolutely. Chris, well, anytime you play with him, it is a different band. Whether it's him or the Punch Brothers or whatever, it's a different thing every single time. What are some of the other, quote, rules for the Tiny Desk Concerts? Whether it's maybe number of people or the length of the set or anything?
We try to keep these to 15 minutes, three songs. You know, sometimes they spill over. We had Mr. Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead recently.
Oh, wow.
You know, you're not going to be able to keep Bob to 15 minutes because he has a different clock inside than most people. And that is often true of some of the jazz artists we bring in. They just get warmed up about 12 minutes in. But having restrictions helps inspire artists to do something that they might not ordinarily do. They might put a medley of four or five songs together in that 15 minutes. You know, it gives them something to work with, and I like the challenge. I like to give the challenge.
Sure, I would think. I read somewhere that perhaps it was Anderson .Paak's appearance on the series. That would be, so far, Tiny Desk Concert's most popular video. Can you read in possible reasons for the incredible popularity of this particular episode? Maybe the most bleepable show, but beyond that?
It was really good. And it's funny that we're talking today because 2 hours ago, just today, the Free Nationals, Anderson .Paak's band, came to play a Tiny Desk on their own, and Anderson came and joined them for a song. So quite an auspicious question there.
Let's move on quickly then to the Tiny Desk Concert Contest. When and why did this even come about? You were getting a slew of submissions anyway, I suppose. How did this one happen for you?
I think a lot of the submissions I get are coming from artists who are somewhat established. And we wanted to reach into the bedrooms and kitchens of America and get to the artists that we would never, ever hear. And we wanted other people to hear those artists. And so this was a way to do that. So people can now submit up until March 30th, submit a video of themselves or their band or their friends performing an original song behind a desk of their choosing and send it our way. And you just have to be over 18 and live in America.
Okay, well, easy enough. I've seen some wonderful bands throughout their submissions, whether or not folks that I know, even the Vagabond Tales for one, submitting really interesting concepts on what could be a tiny desk. And so I suppose we're just looking for the humorous or the outlandish here. What are a few examples you can think of with regard to creative use of a, quote, tiny desk, makeshift or real?
Well, I've seen them put it underwater.
That's good.
Sometimes they're just hand drawings. Sometimes they're at the kitchen table, and you have to kind of look and see, where's the desk in this one? I think a band put one up on top of a mountain. It's pretty great.
Yeah,
use your imagination when you make this video. I mean, it's not the thing that's going to make you win, but it'll stand out.
It'll be an eye catcher at least. Okay, now actually just getting away from this, there's just a couple of things that I want to touch on away from this. As the local All Things Considered host, I always wanted to send a kudos to the person that chose the music in between the segments, because quite often they would tie into the story just ahead or just past, and sometimes not in an obvious way. That's you. You were the director of ATC, and then you were choosing the music. And so I guess before it started being so topical, for lack of a better sterile word there, for the bumper music, was it at one point much more generic before you started to be much more relatable to whatever stories were coming up or just passed?
So I started directing All Things Considered around late 89, early 90, and that's a long time ago. But when I came, it was a bit of a signature. I was a listener before I came to NPR, and it was something that always attracted my attention to NPR. No one ever puts interesting music between news stories, for goodness sake. Hey, my life was about music when I came on to direct All Things Considered, and I used it and tried to be as humorous and sensitive to the subject matter as I could. And for 18 years, I did that, and I had a lot of fun. There are many talented directors still doing that today. It's a really amazing and fun job, you know, because your challenge is something's on the air right now. It's going to end in a minute. You sense the tone of the story. You have 25 seconds to fill. The next story is funny, but this one now isn't. How do you get there? And so it's this constant little brain puzzle, and you think of all the music that, well, at least the way I did it, is I would think of the music I know and have. Sometimes I'd run to my office at the last second, grab a CD. I think these days they're all digital files. And at the last second, I'd hand an engineer a piece of music and tell him to throw it in the CD player and hit it. Now these days, of course, it's all digitized and a little easier, a little less running.
Yeah, I think what stands out the most for me on that, it was Joni Mitchell, but it wasn't even her. It was Herbie Hancock from his disc, I think it was called The River, but it was her music. And so that was the tie-in. And that was just the one that, as a music and jazz geek and all sorts of geekdoms here, that would work out. Well, speaking of geekdoms, and before we wrap up, I have to hear about the fact that you voiced yourself in an episode of The Simpsons. How did this happen?
They called me up and asked me, and I thought, wow, sure.
So talk about this call. I mean, if you would, you were sitting there, and I don't imagine you generally expect a call from whoever it is. I'm sure it wasn't Matt Groening himself.
No, it wasn't. But they pitched me the idea. I was going to be the host of, I can't remember the name of the show, but it was a takeoff on Mountain Stage. And I was the voice of that show. And I just thought, what a funny idea. Because, you know, I love NPR, but boy, we can poke fun at it. We deserve to have fun poked at us. And we can certainly have fun poking fun at ourselves. And The Simpsons gave an opportunity to make that happen.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Nearly 30 years of poking fun at my own philosophical love right here in the world of NPR. So that's just truly incredible. Well, again, we mentioned that the entries for the Tiny Desk Concert Contest, these entries will be accepted up until March 30th. Any other constraints, or what do people need to know beyond the location to get more information?
They should search Tiny Desk Contest and look for the rules. But the basic rules are be over 18. You can't make yourself be over 18, but you have to be over 18. And you want to present an original song. And not only that, but you have to be a U.S. citizen. Oh, and you can't be signed to any kind of record label. So those are the three, like, you can't break those rules. But then, you know, you can use your imagination on the desk. You can play around with that rule. There has to be a desk, but, you know, imagine it.
Ah, gotcha. So truly still independent for anybody at this point. Yeah. Okay, cool. To wrap, I suppose, at one point it was, I think, maybe more of a focused on a singer-songwriter approach, or, you know, I don't want to define it too much. This was what little criticism that I read somewhere that I disagree with. But there were some genres people felt were excluded, like, say, country and hip-hop. But then again, public radio, it's our place to give you what you cannot get or won't get on the rest of the dial. But having said that, is there any constraint as far as genres? Can people send in a flute through the canyon or a singer-songwriter duo,
please,
or just anything?
Yes, please. Yes,
yes, yes. Oh, in fact, on this week's All Songs Considered, Lars Gotridge, a resident metal fanatic, begged people who are into metal to please, we don't get enough metal submissions, please submit. We try, when we judge these things, to not judge them based on the things that we like musically. You know, our tastes are not important. Seeing talent is what's important. So that's the key. Submit your thing if you're proud of it. That's probably the best thing I can say, no matter what it is. Tiny Desk Concerts grew out of that whole idea of seeing an artist at a place we couldn't hear and then winding up with a very intimate sounding performance, and that's where that came from. So we're going to videotape this for our blog, and maybe it's the start of something and maybe it's not.
That was Bob Boylan, host and creator of the NPR Tiny Desk Concerts. And a reminder again that the submission deadline for the NPR Tiny Desk Concert Contest is March 30th. Again, a quick internet search for Tiny Desk Contest will get you there. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Find many past KVC Arts programs via podcast through iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and NPR One. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Let's go now to Lillian Vasquez in conversation with an Emmy Award winner known as a television host, a composer, a performer, and more, John Tesh.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you. And the way you look tonight.
You have a new public television special that will be airing across the country, including on our public television station, KVCR, in March, as part of the pledge schedule. The title of the special is John Tesh, Songs and Stories from the Grand Piano. And of course, I want to talk more in depth with the TV special, but first I'd like to step back and look at your past and see how you got to this point.
Sure.
You grew up in New York, where you call yourself a band geek. It seems that being a band geek paid off. Share a little bit about your band geek days, or the days of nights band and playing at school dances.
A lot of these stories are fresh in my mind. I just, to coincide with the PBS special, I just released a memoir called Relentless, the story of my life and the story of a cancer battle that I got on the other side of successfully. Yeah, the band geek thing was a big deal, and I was born in 1952. And so in the 60s, I think everybody that I knew was either on the football team, or they were in the marching band, or they were garage bands, right, a rock and roll band. And so I was way too skinny to make it onto the football team, and so they stuck me in band. And back in the day, it wasn't, now it's very cool to be in band. Back in the day, it wasn't so cool. It's just like, that's where the geeks went, and that's how the word band geek, I guess, got formed. I started when I was 7, and so what I learned in second grade from a man named Dr. Thomas Wagner, our band leader, who became the New York State Teacher of the Year a couple of times, he taught me a process of focused practice and risk and intensity that, as I went back and connected the dots working on the autobiography, I realized that I've taken everything that I learned in band through to everything that I've done since. And so the Band Geek thing worked out for me pretty well.
Yes, it certainly did pay off. You continued to love music, obviously. You went on to college, and you were going to be, I guess, a major in the science field, but you ended up taking a little bit of the communications curriculum, and I was thinking maybe you were thinking, let me take an easy class like TV or Radio 101.
That's exactly what happened. Is that my father was in the textile business. He was one of the vice presidents of Hanes Underwear. Oh. And, you know, I grew up playing instruments and being in theater and everything, and that's what I wanted to do. So when it came time to visit schools, you know, I wanted to visit, you know, Interlochen Performance Academy, you know, in Michigan, and USC in California, and Berkeley in Boston. And he said, now, I've enrolled you in North Carolina State. You're going to be in textile chemistry, and you can follow my footsteps, and you can have a proper job. So I tried that for two or three semesters, and I was miserable. Oh. And I did. I took a TV radio course because I heard it was an easy A. It wasn't so much an easy A, but I did get bitten by the bug. And I wanted to change my major, and I tried to change my major by going to all my professors to get them to sign the drop ad cards. They all did except one, my statistics professor, and then I made a fateful decision on advice from one of my fraternity brothers to sign my professor's name on the drop ad card because I was told that they never look at those.
Ooh.
And but he did. I got suspended from the university, and my dad threw me out of the house, and so I was living in a tent at 19 and a half years old. I was living in a tent in Raleigh, North Carolina, pumping gas and working construction. And I begged my way onto a radio station to sort of sweep floors and run the religious tapes on Sundays and got my foot in the door. And that's how my, you know, radio and media career started. But I burned my ships pretty badly. And I got thrown out of everything. My girlfriend broke up with me. The university broke up with me. My parents tossed me out. But it made a man out of me, you know.
It kind of sounds like a country music song. I'm surprised you didn't write it.
No, I've never heard it said like that, but I've told this story many times. You're the first person to say, and I think that's very, very accurate. Yeah, I'm going to work on that. I have some friends who live in Nashville.
I think it'll work well.
Just the way you look tonight.
Tell me about your first paying real job working in radio or television, whichever it was.
The first paying job was I made minimum wage on Sundays. I worked from 4:30 a.m. to 7 a.m. playing Billy Graham tapes and other tapes that the radio station WKIX in Raleigh had to play, you know, as part of their public service announcements.
Right.
And one day, one of the tapes broke. I may have been responsible for that. I can't really remember. And I switched on the microphone and started doing my own show. And the news director of the station said, "Hey, listen, I've heard you. You know, I keep hearing that the tapes are breaking on Sundays, and I hear you're doing some stuff." And he says, "I know what you're doing." And I said, "Oh, I'm really, really sorry. Are you going to fire me?" He said, "No, I'm going to give you another job because you're pretty ingenious guy." And so he gave me a job reading the news on Sunday afternoons and Saturdays as well on WKIX, which was a big station. It was a big AM station back in the day. And then I ended up, I got a part-time job developing the news film at the local TV station. And then the anchorman showed up one day. He had been drinking, and they fired him. And I was the only guy under 84 years old at the station. And so I ended up being the anchorman. So it was just sort of like I was just sort of in the right place at the right time. Had a couple of those things that didn't work out. But it was really wild, Lillian, because within 36 months later, I was anchoring the news in New York City at WCBS. And wow. It was just, yeah, I know. And none of that would have happened if my statistics professor hadn't been honorable, right, and caught me. And if my dad hadn't been honorable and said that, you know, I was a liar and a cheat and he was going to throw me out of the house. And I reconciled with everybody after that.
Good.
But if they hadn't done that, I wouldn't have. I had no choice but to go find a job, basically.
But it also clearly showed your talents and your ability to read and to voice and to look into a camera and to look good on camera. So it didn't just happen. I mean, you had a lot of it to make it happen. You had the substance.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that, but there was. I don't think I had as much innate talent as I've seen over the years other people have. In fact, I'm sure I didn't, but I had. There were a couple of people that I was watching at one at the news station, the radio station, the other at the TV station, and I watched how they rehearsed, and so I grabbed hold of that, and I was relentless, to use that word again, in rehearsing and being persistent and sort of being found ready, right? So when there was nobody else to anchor the news in Raleigh, and I was the only guy there. I'd been pulling TV news scripts out of the wastebasket and practicing in my mirror at home. So it wasn't like I was running out asking people, hey, can you hire me? When the opportunity arose, I was, and there's actually a chapter in the book called Be Found Ready. I was, for the most part, ready. I didn't have the clothing for it. I didn't have a jacket. I knew actually I had to read news, and I had copied people, and I'd really investigated and mimicked some of the greats.
Well, then I rest my case. You were prepared. You were practicing in your own way, getting ready, because not just anybody can do that. I know people think it looks easy, but not everyone can do it. And you were practicing on the sidelines to get thrown into the game.
Yeah, I mean, you're rewriting my book for me.
Oh, sorry.
It's your instincts are great. I mean, because it's the same thing that I did. I was a walk-on athlete at NC State University is a Division I school, and so I had played some soccer and some lacrosse in Garden City, but I was determined that I was going to play for NC State, and so I actually walked onto both of those teams, but I was the guy in the, you know, at night after everybody left, who was kicking the ball up against a brick wall, you know, 1,000
feet.
In my book, there's a story that was written, you know, a year before Kobe Bryant's fateful accident. But when you study somebody like Kobe and LeBron James and Michael Jordan, people like that, yeah, they've got talent. But when you look at their work ethic, it's really crazy. I think we've lost a little bit of that these days. But because there's so much distraction out there, if you are up for deliberate practice, focused intensity, you can really make your way in this world.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is composer, author, TV, and radio host John Tesh. John has a new public television special, John Tesh Songs and Stories from the Grand Piano. Now, you worked in New York, and then you went on to co-host Entertainment Tonight with Mary Hart, where you stayed for 10 years. Now, I always wondered, why did you leave the world at that time?
Why did I leave Entertainment Tonight at that time?
Yeah.
Wild thing is that Entertainment Tonight was almost like a retirement for me. I know that sounds weird, but I had been through, I had worked in Raleigh, Durham, Orlando, Nashville with Pat Sajak and Oprah Winfrey and a bunch of people there. And then New York City, when I was 23 years old, I was the youngest correspondent there. And in that newsroom was, you know, John Stossel, Meredith Vieira, Bill O'Reilly, and Brian Williams, and a whole bunch of other reporters, who all Cub reporters at the same time. And then I got hired by CBS Sports to live in Europe for 6 years, and I was covering, you know, the Olympics and downhill skiing and all the rest of that stuff. And so by the time I was, like, you know, 33 or 34, I was exhausted. I was ready to quit. And I got this call. Somebody had found an old tape of mine anchoring the news in Nashville, and it was Paramount Television, who produced Entertainment Tonight. And so they said, hey, I wasn't interested in the job, but they said, if you come out here, this is where they make movies. We know you want to do movie music, and you only have to work half a day. So I worked 4 hours a day at ET. And the wild part, 23 million people a night saw Entertainment Tonight. So all of a sudden, everybody knew who I was.
I was one of those people watching Entertainment Tonight for years. Now, during your Entertainment Tonight years, who did you interview that left either a lasting impression, or you thought, holy cow, I'm interviewing this person, or you thought, I'd like to be friends with this person?
You know, I didn't do a lot of the interviews on ET. That was the weirdest thing, because I'm enamored of people who are at the top of their game. I always have, and I've always sort of strived to see if I could, you know, get there and study them and everything. So when Eric Clapton would come up to be interviewed about an album that was coming out, or Billy Joel or Elton John or, you know, Peter Gabriel, any of these guys that I loved. The actors and actresses it wasn't that much of a big deal for me, because I didn't know half of them anyway, based on my background. So I just sort of asked them the questions I wanted the answers to. But with the music artists, I was usually frozen in my tracks. Mm. It was tough to ask them questions. But back in the day, 1986, there wasn't any cable, really, right?
Right.
And there wasn't Extra, there wasn't Access Hollywood. There wasn't E! Entertainment, and the nightly news was not doing stories on Michael Jackson. So we were the only, if you wanted to see a movie trailer, you either saw it in the movies or you saw it on Entertainment Tonight. There was
exactly.
no other place to see it.
Right.
People weren't sharing that on their smartphone. There was no smartphone. It was a very friendly time. In other words, we had a great relationship with the stars and their publicists, and it was somebody had something to promote, we helped them, and if there was a, I mean, the reviewers would do their job. If there was a bad film, it was a bad film. But there was nobody was waiting outside somebody else's house with a smartphone and then sending it to TMZ. There wasn't any of that. It was a kinder, gentler time, and it was a lot of fun.
So the music artists were the ones that kind of left you thinking, wow, I just talked to, or I just did this thing with Billy Joel or Elton John.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of these guys weren't that much older than me either. That was the thing that really scared me, was just how did they get to the top of their, craft like that? And you talk to somebody like, Billy and all three of them, Billy, Elton, and Eric Clapton, all had problems with drugs and alcohol because
right.
there was, so much fame so quickly. I had an opportunity, especially with Sting and also with Billy Joel, to go out and cover them when they were touring. So I would be there during their sound check, which is basically, in the afternoons, 2 or 3 hours when they're getting used to the venue and playing with their band, maybe learning a new song or something. And so I picked up tricks even there that
Sweet.
I use today when we still do 30 concerts ourselves, And so having a chance to get inside that process, and I use that word a lot in my book, is when you work a process, I have goals, right? But I don't really ever see the goal as the number one thing. When I wake up every morning, I work the same process every day, and it's sometimes I get pulled out of it and I get back into it. But that was a sameness that I found in a lot of these high achievers, was that they were persistent, they had grit, they were relentless in the process that they worked every day, whether it was practice or it was artistic work or even writing a novel.
E.T., which is still on today, what's changed about the show other than the theme song, but what about the style and the content?
E.T. is actually a good show. The content is shorter, but I think that about 2 or 3, maybe 5 years ago, there was a real competition for sort of getting inside people and ambushing people. And, there have been some collisions with celebrities where they stopped talking to those shows and things like that. I think
right.
everybody has backed off a little bit. But Entertainment News, when Entertainment Tonight first came on, people wouldn't tell you that they watched it because it was embarrassing. I didn't watch that show. You know what I mean? In fact, the guys that launched it, they were told by many people in the business, way up top in the business, that it would never work because people didn't want that much entertainment. But it's become a commodity now.
Yeah.
I mean, you can share entertainment right this second on your Instagram feed or Facebook or whatever. So it's the shows aren't as popular, but they're still there. But I do think the relationship with the celebrities I've seen, because we do have some friends that are still in the business, and I think the relationship is a little more of a partnership now. It's not as confrontational.
I don't know that you answered the question. Why did you leave, or did your contract not get renewed, or did you just not want to do that for four
oh,
hours
gosh.
A day?
I'm talking to Ted Koppel here. I'll have to tell you that story sometime. When I was at E.T., this really ties in nicely, and this is actually in the show. I talk about this in Songs and Stories. I wanted to be a full-time musician, and I couldn't get anybody to sign me because I was the host of Entertainment Tonight. I thought that would actually be
helpful.
Something helpful in the plus
yeah.
column, right? An asset, but it wasn't. They just didn't want Arista Records, Columbia Records, and A&M, they didn't want this guy who read the celebrity birthdays on their label. And so I saw the Moody Blues on PBS live at Red Rocks. And then I saw Yanni, who ultimately became my friend. I saw him at the Acropolis.
Yep.
And I went to my wife and I said, that's what I need to do. And she said, well, I said, I need to raise my hand and say to the world, this is where my passion is, my heart is, my music. So we actually went to PBS, and this is in the book, and it's also on the show. And I said, hey, here's my idea. I'm going to play my music with the Colorado Symphony Orchestra at Red Rocks, this ancient amphitheater. I'm even going to have Olympic athletes, Bart Conner and Nadia Comaneci. I'm going to have them performing in the venue and all that. It'll be really unique. It'll be like the Olympics. And they said, well, how many records are you selling? And I said, well, I'll get 50 a week. How many concerts are you doing a year? And then I said, one. And they said, well, you're not really Neil Diamond, are you? And I said, no. And they said, well, listen, if you make this special, we'll take a look at it, but there's no guarantees. So I went back to Connie and my wife, and long story short, we took a second mortgage on our house, wow, invested in this thing, and after about, and there we were, 1994, and with my 8-week-old daughter in the audience with Connie, and 4 songs in, it started raining, which is always does at Red Rocks, but it rained like sideways. And so the orchestra left, and we were just left there with our 4 band members. We continued to play in the rain because the audience wouldn't leave. And after about another 3 or 4 songs, we were all soaked. The audience was going nuts, and the moon came out, rain stopped, orchestra came back, and we continued playing. And then Linda Taggart, who was this wonderful lady at the Maryland Public Television, tested the show at midnight on a Sunday, and it out-tested the 3 tenors in that terrible time period. And she said, I think you've got something here. And I think you've got something here. I went from selling 50 records a week to 50,000 a month, and put together a 50-city tour that was sold out. There was 10,000 people a night coming to this show. I mean, it was crazy. This was 1995 at that point. I had to choose whether to continue to be a television presenter or a full-time musician, and I chose musician.
Well, yay for public television for sure.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Let's go back now to Lillian Vasquez in conversation with John Tesh. KVCR-TV is airing John Tesh, Songs and Stories from the Grand Piano through early May. More at kvcr.org/schedule.
In this show, your newest show, you obviously are very comfortable at the microphone as well as speaking to the audience and playing the piano. I'm guessing years in this business allowed you, because, you know, not all performers are comfortable or as comfortable as you seemed talking to the audience. They kind of want to play their music, stay in that zone, but you go back and forth quite easily telling stories and playing your music.
I'm chuckling here because I hate it.
Oh, really?
No, I shouldn't say that. I do enjoy it now that it's at this level, but I was not good at it. I am the guy you described. I'm the guy who wants to show up and play 12 or 13 songs.
Really?
Maybe introduce a few things and move on. But I realized that what happened was almost exactly 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with what ended up being terminal cancer. And so I was going through all these treatments and everything, but we still had concerts booked, and I had to go on stage. Mm-hmm. And it was obvious there's something wrong with me because I was losing so much weight. So I started telling, you know, just sort of being honest with the audience and telling stories. And then because they really had the energy to play so many songs, I was telling stories about growing up as a band geek. And then people were laughing and they were enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine who was an artist had to illustrate some of the things, so, you know, because I didn't have pictures of me in the band, and I just didn't have them anymore. And so he was illustrating stuff, and we were doing, you know, funny things between songs. And so over a 3-year period, while I was getting healed, I was developing this this new muscle that you're talking about, which was just having comfort. And I mean, I'm comfortable talking to an audience, but this is stuff that's a little more complicated. You know, it's stories that have a beginning and an end, because my wife always says that my stories never have an end. So what you see in the PBS special is, I don't know, maybe 30 shows of me getting ready for, you know, for that. And I still feel like I could have done a better job. I think I have an unfair advantage, because for a lot of people who are 45 years old or 50 years plus, it's a second reference for them, because they knew me from Entertainment Tonight, or maybe they knew me from the news or sports or something like that. I could tell them stories about my life that they haven't heard before, but they're comfortable understanding that, oh, this is the guy that I used to watch when he was doing that. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
So, and let's follow him on this journey. And even when I did Live at Red Rocks, it was a shock to people, because people were like, wait a second, this is the guy who was on Entertainment Tonight, and all of a sudden he's on stage with an 80-piece orchestra. And a lot of people made fun of that. They were, especially the late night guys, like, you know, what is this guy doing? But then it ended up giving people, because I've heard from, you know, hundreds of them, it gave people the impetus and the encouragement to go follow their own dream. But thanks for the compliment about the talking. It was another one of those things where I had to learn how to do it. I mean, I studied comedians, I studied public speakers, you know, and and it's a different muscle.
I thought that you did such a good job. Normally, I think like a David Foster who plays the music, talks, and he hosts the show. He did a special a few years ago for public television, David Foster, Hitman and Friends, and he carried it very well. And not everybody can do that because, like I said, they either want to be singing and performing, and I thought you did it beautifully, or I wouldn't have said it. So,
well, I appreciate it. I know David very well. I've actually played with David, and David's doing nothing more than the way he is in person. You know, I mean, he's probably one of the most confident musicians, and that's really how he's gotten where he's gotten, because he's just so confident in his playing and deserves to be. But that's him. He's a great guy.
He's he's very charismatic. He's a good storyteller, and then he obviously has the talent to back it. When he did his public television special, he was a guest here at our studio and interviewed him on television. And I will say, I still get compliments on that show because it's not me. It's him. You know, he just has that ability to be charming and good storyteller, and he has a lot of good stories. You know, so that helps as well.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned
he's operated at such a high level, but he was. Also, you know, he came over here came to the States from Canada, same time Paul Schaefer did, you know, from the from David Letterman band. Yeah. He's definitely paid his dues. But I'm doing this show, and I did this show, the Songs and Stories show. That's the show I would want to see from my favorite artists. You know, and a lot of artists are doing that now. I mean, look at even Bruce Springsteen, you know, with his memoir, the Broadway show he did. You really want to understand, instead of, and here's another album of new songs, you really want to understand what people are thinking when they're going through this. And so my life is really sort of a multimedia life, and we treat it that way on stage, and you've seen the show, whereas one of the stars of the show are these screens behind us where, as I'm talking, it's all there. It's me performing with, you know, Olympic figure skaters. It's me performing with basketball players during the, you know, the NBA basketball theme, and me performing with my family. You know, my daughter Prima is dancing, and Gib is playing ukulele.
So that's my next question. In the show, you have both your children on stage, your daughter Prima and your son Gib. Tell me about that. And, you know, did you have to beg them to do it, or were they, "Dad, we're in"? How was that?
It happened organically. Where you know, if you were to come over tomorrow and my grandkids were here, you know, Gibbs' kids, 8, 6, and 3, you'd pretty much just, you might not see that show, but you'd see a show where the girls go upstairs and they dress in their fairy outfits, and I'm playing songs from Frozen or making up songs, and they're, you know, they'll play like Rachmaninoff piece and they'll interpret that. And then the 3-year-old boy, you know, he's got a monster truck and he wants to hear monster truck music. And so that, it was like that when we were with Gib and Prima, you know, Gib is 38, Prima's 25, when they were little kids. And I mentioned this on stage, is that Prima was always dancing next to my piano. And so when she ended up getting a job out in Los Angeles she has a dance degree, but when she got a job as a fitness instructor, she could move her schedule around so she could come and, and they're hilarious. The two of them are hilarious. We have a large family. I mean, Prima is 6'1", Gib is 6'4", I'm 6'6", you know, Connie's 5'11", or something, you know, and so it's a lot of person on stage, a lot of people on stage. I think it just happens automatically. Hey, you want to come out and do some stuff? You know, and Gib's a great comedian. I mean, I am paying them. There's that.
You know, you've written so many theme songs over the years, music that played with the NBA for years. In fact, you joke about it in this TV special that the NBA theme put two kids through college. Is that right? Do you just get residuals every time that song plays, or how did that work?
You do. I mean, you do. And it's not what it used to be, but now Fox has picked it up, and so it's on college basketball now. It's pocket change every time it gets played, but when you talk about being played 10,000 times, there is a college tuition in there somewhere, you know.
Sweet.
But there are, I mean, imagine John Williams and Hans Zimmer and all those guys. That the basketball theme is really my most recognizable song. And so, yeah, it did produce some revenue. But even more than that, it's the one galvanizing part of the show where men who have been dragged to a John Tesh concert by their wives or girlfriends, that's the first time they actually start paying attention.
Is when they hear the NBA theme.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, their arms come unfolded.
Like, I know that song. You've made reference to your wife, Connie Sulica, who is your beautiful wife and has been for many years. How did you and Connie meet?
We met in a gym in Palm Springs in 1991, and we were the only two people in the gym. I was doing a function for Entertainment Tonight, and she was shooting a series for CBS called P.S. I Love You. And so I walked in, and we were the only two people in the gym, and I wasn't going to say anything to her. She was, you know, really celebrity royalty, and had just been voted, I think, one of the top three most beautiful women in the world by People Magazine. So I was averting my eyes. And as I was walking out, she said, "Hey, John Tesh, is that you?" And I sort of whipped around and said, "Oh, Connie Sulica, I didn't see you there." And she goes, "Well, you know, we're the only two people in the gym." You know, and I said, "Oh, you may be right." You know?
Smooth, John, smooth.
Very.
Now, are you going to take this show, this public television show, on the road? I know that usually takes funders and sponsors and all of that, but will you be performing this show on the road?
Yes, for sure. I mean, it's the same model as when we were supporting PBS, you know, back, you know, 25 years ago was when Red Rocks was. And so we're definitely doing that. It won't be one of those, you know, 50-city contiguous tours. Those are the best ones to do, financially anyway, because you get in the buses and you go. And you don't have to, you know, public television has, you know, a 3-year contract with this show, and so.
And do you think you'll be doing one here in Southern California?
Oh, for sure. Oh, excellent. Absolutely. Although my wife won't come to the Southern California shows. It's the funniest thing.
Why?
She gets nervous. She gets nervous for me. Yeah. She's a very shy person. And she directed the Songs and Stories PBS special, and she writes a lot of the material too. But it's really funny, you know, a famous actress, and she'd rather be behind the scenes. So she's always helping me and Gib and Prima with everything, and she's really the wizard behind the curtain.
Well, that makes for a great team. I'm so glad to hear that. I want to ask you lastly, will you share what your current project, Intelligence for Your Life, what is that?
When I left Entertainment Tonight, went out and toured and started my own record company. It was really a family record company. And I was gone a lot. And then when Prima was in elementary school, it was clear that Connie was a single parent. And I was on the road too much. And so I realized that I needed to cut that, you know, way down, and also figure out a way to, you know, to support my family. And I had started, obviously, in radio. And so I was trying to figure out what kind of a radio show. Maybe I could do a syndicated radio show, and I substituted for Casey Kasem in a Countdown show. That was interesting, but it didn't really have any purpose, you know, I was a big purpose guy at the time, still am. We were retiring for the night one night when Connie was complaining about my side of the bed, which still is pieces of iPods and keyboards and things, stuff that shouldn't be in the bedroom. And I wanted to cross complain, so I looked over at her side of the bed. And there were stacks of magazines, like Oprah Magazine, Prevention, and Better Homes and Gardens, all these, you know, newsletters and things. And they had yellow sticky notes in there. And I said, "Well, what's all this madness? You know, you look at your side of the bed." She goes, "Well, these are all of the articles that I want to read, but I haven't had time to get around to them. You know, they're pretty long." And the light bulb went off in my head. This was 20 years ago. And I said, "That's a radio show." And because there's a woman like this is looking for, you know, she was 35, 36 at the time, you know, looking for intelligence for her life. Mm-hmm. And so we started with 6 stations. I just called up all these stations and said, "Hey, I have this new radio show." And they're like, "Well, can we hear a demo again?" Yeah, we're just finishing it up. I had nothing but an idea. And actually, the first show started with most of the articles that were in the sticky notes. it's just personal development things, you know. And so we started with 6 stations. And again, we, you know, had to take a big loan against our house because it's cost the same to have 6 stations as it does to have 350, which we do today. And so we do 36 hours of radio a week as a family.
Wow.
And we some of that is music, of course. It's not like it's a talk show all the way through. It's become sort of a monster in popularity, especially in places like Facebook, where our weekly reach in Facebook is something like 18 to 20 million. It's just people who want to find ways to live a better life. And it's forced learning for me. So, and it allows me, since we run the show ourselves, it allows me the opportunity to go out on the road, do concerts, and maybe do the show from the hotel room and things like that.
And lastly, John, you mentioned it briefly, but you did have a health scare a couple of years ago. How are you doing now?
I'm well. And the biggest reason that I wrote the book, and you'll also see it at the, you see it at the end of the show, of this, of the PBS show, is that I was, it was for Connie and I especially, it was, you know, 4 years of just a battle of it was a rare form of cancer, and so it was surgeries and chemotherapy and all weird diets and all kinds of stuff, and it would go away and it would come back, go away and come back, and we were exhausted. And during that period of time, we began to discover something known as divine healing, which is there are scriptures in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, that are the promises of healing. And so we stood on those scriptures, we studied them, and actually went into some groups and studied with other people. And what the last treatment that they wanted to give me, which was about a year and a half ago, would have destroyed my pelvis in so many different ways. I mean, I would have lost, you know, bowel function and bladder function and everything else. And with the 62 treatments they wanted to do. And at that moment, Connie and I had built a faith that was so strong that we took one look at each other in the doctor's office and both raised our eyebrows. And at that moment, I knew that I was healed. And so, and God bless, you know, PBS, who Judy Barlow and the guys at American Public Television, they were like, you should tell this story, you know, because it's your testimony. And so at the end of every one of our concerts, and it'll happen at the end of the show on PBS too, you know, people are like, how do I learn more about this? And it's the power of faith-filled words, and it's the power of positivity of not speaking cancer over yourself. I got cancer the same year in my life that my dad got cancer at 63 and died. And I know that that I clearly manifested that disease in my life because I was so worried about it, you know. Mm. So that's what we do now, is we teach people how not to worry, how not to ruminate, how to transform their minds.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I'm healed and whole, and I'm back to my fighting weight, and everything is good here.
John Tesh, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you and learning so much about your world. And you know, the fact that I'm talking to the anchor of Entertainment Tonight years ago is just a complete honor. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Thanks for asking the challenging questions. And I'll tell Ted Koppel that you did a good job. Him and Mike Wallace.
Thank you, John.
Thanks again.
It's been conversation with and a bit of music from John Tesh in conversation with Lillian Vasquez to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to John Tesh, and thanks also again to NPR's Bob Boylan, with whom we kicked off the show. And with that, a reminder once again that the submission deadline for the NPR Tiny Desk Concert Contest is March 30th. Just do a simple search for Tiny Desk Contest and go from there. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and NPR One, and most past shows are kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR, it's composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.